I think we're here and then here.
Yes, could you talk a little bit about the idea that an experiment can be designed and observed, meaning in 1500, somebody dropped a rock. The rock dropped. That was an activity that occurred. In 1650, somebody dropped a rock, and that was an experiment which you could observe and describe its characteristics. How did that idea that an experiment could actually be designed to test something build up in that period of time?
That's an awfully good question. It took a long time. The notion of looking at the natural world was not a new notion. That was a classic thing. And the Greeks and every other ancient culture knew an awful lot about every plant that grows and this kind of thing. They knew about the constellations. People looked around. It wasn't that only in the 1600s is it the first time that you open the window and look outdoors. But this notion of an experiment, as you say, was a new thing, and it was hard to convince the world that this was a useful way to approach the world. Because the point of an experiment is that you set up things under specific conditions. That is to say, you don't just look at the world as it is. And for the scientists to convince the world that these special, specific, narrow conditions would have any relevance to things in general was a hard argument to make. Everyone who listened to those ideas was perfectly prepared to say, well, it's all very fine in your little simplified world, but we've got real questions to deal with. It took a long time to speak to that argument.
My question really follows on from the previous one, which is, of course, listening to you talk about Plato, it occurred to me that one of the differences was that Aristotle would never have dreamed of actually testing his theories by experiment. People believed for years that Aristotle laid down the number of teeth that were in the human jaw, and they actually didn't open a jaw to count them. But I'm interested in the role of instruments. You mentioned microscopes and telescopes, but and in a sense, what the generation you're talking about had advantage of those. But did you find that there were in the previous century, say, Giordano Bruno, going back, did you find that there were very clever people who had proto-thoughts of these kinds, but simply had no means of testing or analyzing or even observing any of these phenomena?
These are just excellent questions. The technology makes a giant difference. So people have fooled with lenses, for instance. Glasses for nearsightedness and farsightedness had come along way before telescopes or microscopes had. And so people are trying. Leeuwenhoek, who's the name that people know with microscopes, was a cloth merchant who had, he got into these microscopic observations because he wanted to look at the quality of his cloth more closely. And so he made what were essentially magnifying glasses. Mm-hmm. But you could only go so far with these things, regardless of how. When Leeuwenhoek gets his magnifying glasses good enough that he can actually see things through them, there was never anybody as excited as this. He's putting drops of pond water. Look through. He's the first one to see little critters swimming around in the pond water. He scrapes his teeth. He looks at the gunk. He's thrilled with that. He writes to the Royal Society one day. He writes that he's hopped out of bed one night. He says within six pulse beats of, I can't remember how he had just phrased it. At any rate, he becomes the first person to look at sperm cells through the microscope. Little wriggling eels, he writes. Never has anyone seen such a great thing. We don't know if Mrs. Leeuwenhoek thought that this was such an intriguing experiment as he did. But when the tools come along that you could actually use the first telescopes, it wasn't only Galileo who's astonished by them. He has the wit to show them to the John Boehners of the day, the political powers that be. And he climbs them to the tallest tower. He talks about even these ancient Venetian doges, he said, labor their way up the steps to get to the top so they can look at. And what he shows them is not the sun and the moon, which they won't be especially interested. He shows them this. They look far out to sea. They can see which ships are going to be first into harbor with whatever goods they're carrying, and therefore how you can make a killing on the market by knowing ahead of all your competitors. People are astonished by the power of these new tools. I think we're here.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to where you started, which was the fact that the people at that time were not us. And you can view them of that time from writings of people later. I was wondering about if you go back to the original writings of the people discussed, like the watching the animals in the bell jar exploding or whatever else they did. Did you actually go back and read what the people at that time said in the voices of that age, or are you relying on people who had done the studies as historians and so forth, reinterpreting in terms of modern times?
Did I cut corners and take shortcuts, or did I do things properly?
That's not what I meant.
Actually, reading the original accounts is terrific fun because, just as you say, a big part of the attraction is seeing how people took it at the time. One of the favorite things at the Royal Society, for instance, of these early experiments, they were constantly doing transfusions. If you had a fierce German Shepherd and a little lap dog, and you did a transfusion from the fierce dog to the gentle dog, would the gentle dog become fierce? And they were doing this kind of thing, and then they write in their diaries, that was terrific, but what if we took an atheist and an archbishop and we did blood from whistle? this sort of thing. Nobody knew the answer to nearly any question you could ask, and so it's terrific fun to write about there, to read what they make of these things, of the unicorns and the spiders and the transfusions.